And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
In today's podcast, I want to talk about small cap value. And I want to talk about active versus passive. Two very big topics. One is important to me because I think that small cap value should be an important part of a portfolio. And I think large cap value should be an important part of a broadly diversified portfolio, particularly at my age. And when somebody says something that I think could be misleading, at least from all of the numbers I've looked at, then I feel defensive and I want to go to battle, have the debate. On the other hand, the other debate I want to have is active versus passive investing. Being able, or at least claiming that you are able to see into the future. You are able to use experience and all of the analytical tools to determine what would put one security over another in terms of future returns. So I hope I win this debate. It's rather one-sided because the person I'm debating is not here to debate with, but let me use his writings and his marketing material to let him present his side of the debate. The person I'm talking about is Ken Fisher. I'm not a fan of Ken Fisher and his work, his firm's work. Again, they manage $70 billion of other people's money. I'm not a fan, but it isn't because he believes in active over passive, which is which probably could be okay. It won't hurt people to the extent that it will cause them to have much lower returns, but some lower returns, more than likely. But from having been in the trenches and talked to Ken's clients, so when I say Ken, I think he has 2,500 employees, but so individually there are advisors there and people who are really doing the heavy lifting, I suspect, but his name is on the door. Ken, in chapter 9 of the book entitled The Little Book of Market Myths, chapter 9 is the perma superiority of small cap value. And the myth he believes here is small cap value stocks are just better than other stocks. Now, by the way, to start with right there, I don't think that, at least the people that I have read that led me to understanding the impact of small cap value and why it has paid a nice premium, and not without taking more risk, by the way. It wasn't magic. But it isn't a matter of looking at value stocks being better than other stocks one by one. It is the asset class itself. All of the stocks as a group compared to all of the small cap growth stocks, for example, or all of the large cap value, or all of the large cap blend, which is a combination of both growth and value, but it isn't about any individual issue, but the group itself. But here is what he says in chapter 9 of the myths. This is a myth many professional investors and hardcore enthusiasts tend to fall for. I'm sure he would think of me as a hardcore enthusiast. The belief that small cap value is inherently better and prone to long-term superiority moving forward forever and ever, world without end. Amen. Well, let me just stop right there. I don't have any belief that stocks will necessarily do better than bonds. In fact, for a very long period, it turns out that bonds have done better than the S&P 500. So I'm certainly not believing that I know what the future will bring. Really, what we know about the past is a strong base of information that suggests that small will do better than large, and that value will do better than growth. And those beliefs are really about the risk factors and the size factors. But he says, as an example, since 1926, small cap stocks have annualized 11.9% to the S&P 500's 9.9%. Proof that small cap is perma better? Not really. A lot of that performance ignores huge bid-ask spreads common in small cap stocks in the 30s and 40s, sometimes up to 30% of the purchase price. If you actually bought and sold small cap stocks, then costs ate up a major chunk of your return. But that's not captured in long-term index returns. Well, let me just say about that comment. Yes, it is true. Bid-ask spreads were wider than for small companies and for large companies. You could push a large company around up or down if you tried to buy very much of it. And all of that is ignored when we look back not only at small companies, but at large companies, including the S&P 500. And there was a time when that spread between the bid and ask was regulated. It had to be traded in at least 1/8% amounts, 12.5 cents on the dollar, in order to make the transaction. Today, that difference between the bid and ask could be a penny. Yes, things are different today. There is liquidity today that we didn't have in the 30s and 40s. But if you were buying and holding those stocks in the 30s and 40s, the spread didn't have any impact on you. Now, eventually, when the small cap became large, when the large cap became small, there could be a trade to put it in another asset class. But all of the studies that suggest the rates of return of indexes do not include the drag that the bid-ask spread includes. And certainly, if you traded every week today, or you traded every week in the 30s and the 40s, so you're in and out and trying to capture short-term profits, that certainly would leave you at a loss. But this is not about looking for short-term gains, turning over the portfolios aggressively, looking for the stock that's going to do better. That's more of Ken Fisher's part of the world than it certainly is mine. But that's the start of his attack against the small cap value premium. Outside of just a few of the relatively hugest small cap bounce periods, large cap overall beat small caps, and typically for agonizingly long periods. It can be mentally and emotionally trying investing in an asset style for which the relative payoffs are few and far between. Now, I produced, and we'll have a link to a table. One of our readers put this table together from the data that Dimensional Funds has provided. And that data goes back to 1926 in some cases, 27 in others, 28 in yet others. And I'm talking now about U.S. asset classes. The international asset classes may only go back 30 or 40 years, and some even less than that. But we, in fact, find that to be true for every asset class. We're in the middle of what for many is going to be the most painful period of time that the S&P 500 has been through. We know that from 1926 to 1999, the stock market compounded at about 10%, 10.2 maybe it was, but since then, the return has been about, in fact, less than 6%, about 5.4% through the end of 2017, from 2000 to 2017, an 18-year period. Now, you talk about being tested. I think the only reason, the big difference, if you ever had that kind of an underperformance from a small cap stock, is that you know the big ones. You know they're great companies. You know they're still going to be there a week from now or a year from now or 10 years from now. At least you believe that. With a small company you don't really know that hasn't made a name for itself already and is big enough to survive difficult times, that may be different. So maybe if you have long periods of underperformance, which there are some, and on top of this question about underperformance, and again, I think they all have that problem, the question of whether the big bounces, the big returns, some short periods of time make up a lot of the end result. Well, the fact is, if you look at the S&P 500 from 1926 to 1994, it was a 10.2% compound rate of return. And then, for the next 5 years, 95 to 99, it compounds at 28.6%. Now talk about a big bounce. That is a huge move in the market when the long-term return has been around 10. And then, of course, as I just said, following that, there was a long period at 5.4%. I don't think that the S&P 500 hasn't been aided by some big bounces. Admittedly, you don't expect to see as big a bounce on the upside or the downside with large companies as you will with small, but remember that is the nature. That is what makes those small companies more risky, is that higher volatility. But let me just show you what happens. If you take out that 1995 to 1999 period, and it never happened, you never got that 28.6% for 5 years. The total return from 26 to 2017, not getting those 5 years, would leave you with a 9.2% compound rate of return. So it's true of the S&P 500, and yes, it's true of small cap value, that there'll be periods, long periods of dissatisfaction. But the interesting thing is, as I'll show you in a few minutes, that those periods of dissatisfaction are probably more often experienced by people in the S&P 500 than people in small cap value. But let me talk about this recent period, the period from 2000 through 2017. Now, that was a tough period for the S&P 500, there's no question. But But I do want you to see that relationship between value and growth, and also between large and small. So when I look at the, first of all, the S&P 500, which compounded at 5.4%, while small cap value compounded at 13%. Large cap value, and we think value performs better than growth, compounded at 8.6%. Large cap growth compounded at 4.1%. Value, large, over value, growth. Now, somebody's going to say, but hasn't growth been doing better than value? Yes, growth has been doing better than value recently. But over that entire period, which is the case, as you'll see in a few minutes, that is the most common thing that happens. Now, small cap blend, which was some growth and some value, that compounded at 7.6. Now, I think it's important to mention right there, that's the Russell 2000 small cap blend index. The DFA small cap portfolio, it's not a recognized index like the Russell, but it's a portfolio of basically all of the small cap companies, just not having to pay the price of a very specific portfolio where there's the reconstitution cost when they decide to take one out and put another company in. But the DFA was 11.3 for that same period. When you look at every asset class, large and small and value and growth, for that period from 1970 through 2017, advantage small over large and value over growth. And it didn't just happen in the United States. If you look at emerging markets from 2000 to 2017, the emerging market small was 9.9, the large was 7.7, the value was 11.5, and the growth was 9.3. The academics have broken these asset classes out, and without playing favorites, we're not without assuming that somebody would be smart enough how to pick one stock over another, just owning that asset class. This goes back to maybe that's the argument I'm having, the debate I'm having with Ken Fisher, is it's not about individual companies I'm talking about. It is simply about the asset class. Now, just to show you how screwy things can be, I would guess that in 1999, I would have had a hard time finding anybody that would take the position that for the next 18 years, bonds are going to be better than stocks. And in fact, remember, the S&P 500 compounds at 5.4, but long-term government bonds compounded at 7.3 and corporates at 7.9. So, again, that's a long period of underperformance from 2000 through 2017. Does that mean that we make the decision to get out of all of our stocks and go, our S&P 500, and go put it in government bonds or corporate bonds? Well, I hope not. And then just a quick look at the internationals. Large cap value, 6.8. Large cap growth, 3.7. Small cap value, 11.3. Small cap growth, 7.9. It all fits, and that's over a long period of time. And the good news is, the academics have dug this all out and run it through their computers and gone all the way back to the mid-20s when they could. I made reference earlier to a table that you can find a link for with the description of this podcast. And this is a table that shows the 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, and 40-year period starting in 26, and looking at whatever asset classes were available starting that year and adding the others as they came aboard. And what it was attempting to do is very simple. It doesn't give you the in-depth view of every period for every asset class, but here's what, to make it easy, it does. It picks the number one performer for each of those periods. And when we go out 40 years, and those are the people I truly believe our work can do the greatest good for. When we go out 40 years and look at the small cap value, small cap growth, large cap blend, the small cap value was the best performing asset class in the bunch in 94.3% of the 40-year periods. Small cap growth, zero 40-year periods. Large cap growth, zero 40-year periods. And large cap blend, 3.8%. That would be the equivalent of the S&P 500. So from what I've seen, looking at, in essence, the work of Dr. Fama and Dr. French and the academics both at Dimensional Fund Advisors and those working out of other University of Chicago and other universities, the bottom line is that even in the 20-year periods, and most of us probably are looking forward to another 20, small cap value was the best in 72.6% of those 20-year periods. Large cap growth, 1.3. I mean, there is your growth, there is your large being overwhelmed by the small and the value. Now, I'm not suggesting at my age, even at 65, I would be putting all my money or most of my money in small cap value or small cap. I happen to have evidently drunk the Kool-Aid, because my wife and I, in our equity portfolio, our buy and hold equity portfolio, are 50% small and 50% large. We are more than 50% in value. The balance is in growth, probably 60-40. And we have equal exposure to international markets in the same sizes and growth versus value, etc. So it looks to me like the case can be made, but could the rest of my life find me looking like a dog? Yes, but that probably isn't going to be a very long time, unfortunately. And so it's when we talk to somebody who's in their 20s, they're going to be around for probably 70 years. And I just hate to see them give up the opportunity to have some money in that very productive asset class, small cap value. We did another study. We'll have a link to this one as well. And in this one, we showed the average return, the best return, and the worst return for four U.S. asset classes: large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value. And the average 40-year return, not including expenses, for large cap blend or the S&P 500 was 10.9. For large cap value, it was 13.5. For small cap blend, 13.8. And for small cap value, 16.2. Now, I do believe that today people know enough about small cap that there will be a bigger following in the market, make the market more efficient than it was for a lot of that the earlier years of that 1926 or 28 through 2017 period. And by the way, that same table shows you the best and the worst and the average for 1 year and for 15 years as well. So if you want to immerse yourself in a bunch of numbers that are trying their best to tell a story, trying their best to give you a sense not only of the potential return and the difference between one asset class and another, but it also shows the worst of periods and what you would have been exposed to if you owned these different asset classes, even for a year. And so I think it should hopefully give perspective. When you see a statement from somebody as well-respected as Ken Fisher, I'm talking about a guy who wrote articles, maybe still writes for Forbes, and his father was in the business, and he, I think he was also a writer, and here he's got $70 billion. Now, I've got a quote in here somewhere that somebody said that Ahmed Faber, he says, there's no denying he's a master of the direct mail and online lead generation process. And that growth is probably the reason that he has grown from $1 billion to $70 billion. It's not because of his performance. But understand what he believes. And here's from a piece from Guru Focus. And they picked up a quote from something that came out from the Fisher firm. Fisher Investments fundamentally believes no investing style is permanently superior, but instead we understand that styles and philosophies cycle in and out of favor. As a result, we use a variety of tactics, dynamically managing the client assets over time. This is what we would all love. Basically, it's a form of market timing. I don't care if you're getting in and out of the market every 6 months or every 12 months or every 2 years, changing from growth to value, changing from big to small, changing from short bonds to long bonds. Those are all forms of market timing. It isn't about an individual company. It starts with a belief that one asset class is going to be better than another. Now, we obviously believe, I believe, that some asset classes are better than others because we don't have any peer growth in any of the funds that I recommend at Vanguard and Fidelity and Schwab, etc. We don't believe in peer growth, not because it won't be the best sometimes, it will, just not very often, but because it has so underperformed value that we want to tilt the portfolio to a value and not have a pure 50-50 split. So we don't have any pure growth funds, but we do own some blend funds like the S&P 500. But you see the promise that he's making. We can see the future better than other money managers. We know where the money is going next. And according to experts regarding statistics, if you can prove yourself to be able to do that, whether it's picking asset classes that are going to be good next, or whether it's picking stocks that are going to be best next, that if you can do that for 70 years, it's statistically meaningful that you really got a hold of something. What we find is the managers who are investing in asset classes that they themselves have a superior result end up looking like they are better than others. But it's not because of the individual companies. Once in a while, somebody, let's call them lucky for the sake of discussion, but somebody picks a stock or two or 10 that way outperforms the market, and they look like geniuses. The question is, what is the likelihood they'll find those again in the future? And all of the research says very unlikely. But the sales pitch continues to go on. And this piece of literature continues to go on, too. It says that Fisher Investments uses both qualitative and quantitative tools to analyze markets, sectors, and securities. FI, it says, makes extensive use of computers, computer peripherals, software, and computer databases in screening for securities worthy of investment consideration. FI uses a centralized portfolio management system, which includes block trading, portfolio management, and securities price data collection. In other words, they are studying as hard as they possibly can. And study after study shows that studying harder, unfortunately, does not lead for most investment managers to higher returns. You've seen the SPIVA results. We've talked about that in the past, where less than about 10% of the actively managed funds, by the way, much better than the performance of Ken Fisher, have underperformed the benchmarks themselves. And they finish with this in this particular little piece about what Fisher says. I don't want a lot of good investments. I want a few outstanding ones. Of course, that's what every active manager wants. But he's so good at telling that story. And if you talk to people who are experts on selling, they will tell you it's the story, it's the spin, it's not about the facts, because the facts almost always get in the way of making a sale, and that would be probably the case in Ken Fisher. And I'll tell you what one of the people that work there said that you all, if you're going to use Fisher, should do. They go on though in a 2015 presentation. About the private capital group, this is as opposed to a mutual fund that he was managing at the time, and we'll talk about that fund in just a second. They've closed it down some years ago, but I'll tell you a little history that is an eye opener, I think. But there are five principles of this firm's investment philosophy. One is a fundamental belief in capitalism and in how free capital markets function. And I would agree with that one, that what we're really betting on is that capitalism works. And there are lots of people who believe the markets function well, are fairly reasonable, not all the time. The second principle is the simple notion, in quotes, that the sole determinant of security pricing is the supply and demand for them. Again, I don't think you're going to find many people that are going to disagree with those first two items. And number three, capital markets do a reasonably good job at discounting all widely known information and immediately pricing in that information and investors' expectations. That sounds like Dr. Fama and Ken Fisher are in total agreement. He says, a reasonably good job. at discounting all the widely known information. Number four, any obvious opportunities that arise from widely available news, rumor, and speculation vanish almost immediately as stock prices adjust. That's true. I mean, what it just blew my mind during the 2000 to 2002 sell-off in the tech stocks was how there'd be a piece of news that came out about that company, and within 2 or 3 minutes, this is after the close, in after-hours trading, bam, that stock would be down 25%. And how did they know that was the right price when the next morning the market opened up and was invariably about the same price? How did they adjust that price so instantly, with people all over the world trying to make some decision about that piece of information? Because if something would fall 25% in one day, why wouldn't it overnight cause a bunch of people to rush to sell more? Well, maybe because there are a lot of people rushing to buy it because it's gone down 25%. I can't tell you why, but it always was fascinating how close those two prices were after people not just had 2 or 3 minutes to think about it, but all night to think about it. So I'm thinking that maybe most people are going to agree with those four points. And maybe I would even agree with the fifth point. For active management to add value, it must identify information that is not well known, or to take well-known information and interpret it differently and correctly than others in the market. Yes, I mean, that's true, except why doesn't it say after that, unfortunately, most people aren't able to do this, and much of the time that would be the case at Fisher Investments. And we know that from a track record that is publicly available about his mutual fund. Guru Focus looked at the results of the Purisima Fund. Here's what they concluded. That Ken Fisher, and I'm quoting here, reading from this article, Ken Fisher has a reputation as one of the leading financial gurus in the footsteps of his father, who was equally esteemed. The performance of the Purisima Fund does not support that reputation. As noted, there may be some results that accrue to only his private and institutional clients. At this time of the writing, they had some $78 billion under management, and of that, $219 million was in this fund. But it showed the performance of the work that they do, and I would think that they would look at that as a $219 million account. I don't know how many $219 million accounts that they have, but I would guess that was probably one of their biggest accounts and would not be considered a stepchild to the other works, because this was performance that was going to be public, very public. Guru Focus reports that on a 15-year cumulative basis, PURIX, that's the symbol for the fund that is now closed, logs an average of 4.4% per year versus 5% for the S&P 500. Now, that doesn't sound like much of a difference, except that his fund took a lot more risk, and so they measure that in an alpha, and over the 10 years, that's the longest this alpha shows here, It, in essence, made 4.83% less than the benchmark. And so if you risk adjust the return, it's just not 0.6% difference between themselves and the S&P 500, but rather almost a 5% difference. I wanted to see how what people thought about working for Ken, and I went to Glassdoor, and there were lots of good things that people said about the firm. They charge a very high, I think, and management fee. Again, my biggest complaint is not about the management fee. It's not about the underperformance so much as it is they overexpose people to risk. That's my biggest complaint. And I've talked to people who were all equities at the Fisher organization, and they had a risk tolerance of not losing any more than 20%. I think that somebody either is in the need to close a sale would tell what we call half truths. I call them a lie, by the way. When you don't tell people something that they should know in order to make a real decision, and you know what that is. His portfolios in 2008, they went down 42%, and I don't know how to get without going to the firm to pretend I was going to be an investor there. I don't know how to get the track record. I haven't found it so far. But what one of the people at Fisher said, first he said, Fisher is a poor money manager with a strong sales and marketing team. Now, I don't know that Fisher is a poor money manager. I think what he's doing is not likely to work out as well as just having a buy and hold with the proper amount of fixed income to address your risk tolerance. But other than that, he's a typical money manager, and probably he may be having kind of a bad period, and his strategy will come back later. But the question is not whether his strategy comes back and does well later or not. It is, should you be in active versus passive? And so much of the evidence would say that passive is going to serve your needs. Here is what this person who worked there said. He said, if you are a client of Fisher Investments, and I think the way he phrased this, he's probably talking to people who were considering working or having Fisher manage their money. I recommend you ask your investment counselor for a composite that includes 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10-year returns. And, of course, make sure those returns are after fees. And also probably would be important if you're in a taxable account to find out what the turnover was like and what people would have had to have reported in their taxable accounts, because one of the things that happens with moving around, whether it works out or not, it is likely going to cause more taxable events than you will have in an index fund. So I don't mean to be dissing Ken Fisher. I'm dissing advisors who don't match investors with the right amount of fixed income. And I think possibly what happens is that the people at Fisher believe you should have a lot of equities in your account. At least that's been the evidence from the people that I've talked with who've had Fisher accounts. Now, maybe they've changed. Maybe they have a whole new philosophy of how they try to help people. But I think when you discover that an investor has a stated limit as to how much risk they're willing to take, and particularly if you're in a bull market, because when you're in a bull market, people tend to establish higher levels of risk they're willing to take. They're willing to lose more money because they feel they're going to make a lot of money. And then they find out not only did they not make a lot of money because the next cycle was not as profitable as the last cycle, but the losses were way more than they're likely to be willing to stay the course with. And you can see right now when we're looking back through this period of 10 years, I mean, people can show 10 years performance that just looks amazing. It might be less than the S&P 500. It might be less than small cap value, whatever, but it's good enough for them. But you can't just show people that. You've got to show them the worst of times, because the worst of times are just as real when they happen as the best of times. And I think you all know that studies show the psychology of investing is that we are hurt way more by a dollar's loss than we are a dollar's gain. We feel it emotionally. We don't like it. We want to get away from it. And that causes people to make decisions that if they had maintained the right exposure to fixed income, they may never have gotten to. So I hope some of this is helpful. I'm hoping that most of you already believe in buy and hold. You don't believe in active management. But, you know, $70 billion is $70 billion. And of course, that's even a drop in the bucket compared to what mutual funds will leave on the table that are actively managed. So I want you to have the very best, and nobody knows the very best. So we look for the way of investing that is probably going to be better than almost all of the others. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.